I want to share a letter, and it's too big to put up on the screen, so I'm going to read up until the last part of it. The last part of it's kind of the most interesting thing anyway, although you'll catch on before we get there. This letter is dated January 31st, 1829. Dear President Jackson, the canal system of this country is being threatened by the spread of a new form of transportation known as railroads. The federal government must preserve the canals for the following reasons. Number one, if canal boats are supplanted by railroads, serious unemployment will result. Captains, cooks, drivers, hostels, repairmen, and local tenders will be left without means of livelihood, not to mention the numerous farmers now employed for growing hay for the horses. Number two, boat builders would suffer, as well as tow line, whip, and harness makers would be left destitute. Number three, canal boats are absolutely essential to the defense of the United States. In the event of the expected trouble with England, the Erie Canal would be the only means by which we could ever move supplies so vital to waging modern war. And now for the last part. As you may well know, Mr. President, railroad carriages are pulled at enormous speeds of 15 miles per hour by engines which, in addition to endangering life and limb of passengers, roar and snort their way through the countryside, setting fire to crops, scaring the livestock, and frightening women and children. Yes, you women and children are really vulnerable to those big, bad railroads, aren't you? The Almighty certainly never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speeds. I'm glad those 15-mile-an-hour railroads never became popular. Signed, Martin Van Buren, Governor of New York. Some of you may have seen this on the internet. Some of you may have heard about it in other venues. And guess what? It's not true. And the first way you can tell it's not true is by the date. Back in those days, the inauguration of the president did not take place until March 4th. And so President Jackson did not become president until March 4th. Plus, Martin Van Buren was hoping to get a position in President Jackson's cabinet, and he did. He became Secretary of State. And so he probably would not have written such a letter. The interesting thing about this, though, is that in 1983, it was used as an advertisement for a utility company known as the Virginia Coal Pipeline Associates. It ran an ad, 27 September 1983, in the issue of the Washington Post. The House of Representatives was scheduled to vote that day to decide whether federal rights of eminent domain should be granted to coal and pipeline companies to provide them with the right of way through privately owned land. The companies wanted to send a mixture of coal and water through the pipelines in order to avoid the uncontrolled rates charged by the railroads, which at the time transported 80% of all coal supplies, and the ad exhorted House members to vote in favor of the proposition. Now, the use of this Van Buren Canal letter in the advertisement prompted the Washington Post to actually research it and publish a letter debunking it by one of their writers, Robert McCloskey. The advertising agency which placed the ad, Martin Agency, Inc., had assured the Post's advertising department that the letter was authentic. The agency had been in turn assured by Charles M. Guthridge, who was senior vice president of Transco Coal Company, which was a partner with the Virginia Coal Company, or Virginia Coal Pipeline Associates, that the letter was authentic. Guthridge maintained that the letter was in Transco's files. We've got it on file. When he joined the firm in the previous year, and that it was not fabricated to suit our advertisement, it was found by researchers in the transportation industry and had been used in past speeches and other publications. In other words, they've been using it for a long time, and so we're going to use it too. Some may think that the internet today has made this kind of stuff possible that gets out there and what they're calling today fake news. But part of, and I'll tell you a little bit about why this is pertinent. But actually, fake news and such have been around. We call them rumors and gossip. When I was a senior in high school, in either 70 or 71, one of my classmates named George died actually at school. It turned out he had an aneurysm in his brain, and it burst, and he died probably within minutes. However, though, the story around school was that our vice president, whom none of us liked, although I had never had the privilege of being disciplined by him, because I had a mother and father who took care of that at home. But anyway, nobody liked our vice president, our vice principal, and there was a rumor going around that he thought George was on drugs and stuck him in a closet, and that's where he passed away. And this caused a lot of anger in the students towards our vice principal that he would do something like that. And so, see, this is kind of what fake news and rumors and so forth does. It creates an anger. And in fact, right now there's so much rioting, the lights went out. Actually, there's rioting in St. Louis. It's called protesting. In Denver, Toronto, Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City seemed surprising to me. Austin, West Palm Beach, Washington, D.C., Berkeley does not surprise me at all. They've been rioting and protesting since the 60s. And New York City. Hopefully you can see this. No, you can't see that very well, can you? Oh, well. Maybe I'll try to get pictures aren't quite so. So anyway, that's an O'Reilly Auto Store. All of its windows are broken. It looks good on my computer. Why don't you come home and you can see my computer? Oh, yeah, Bill can see. We'll all go back to the booth. And, Bill, you can just go in there. We'll only charge you $1 to go up there and take a look at the picture. But anyway, this O'Reilly Auto Store, we just got a new one down on Bay Street here in Eustis. The windows are all smashed, and it's all trashed around there, and so forth. And you know what's kind of interesting, and maybe this kind of shows you a little bit of my political side, saw on Facebook this theme saying, back in 17, whatever, they destroyed property, speaking about the Boston Tea Party, and today they're destroying property, so what difference does it make? Part of the problem is, of course, if back then they targeted one particular item. Today they're just going around smashing all kinds of buildings and so forth. And it's kind of amazing to me that some of these people went out and protested, a stoppage on certain visas from certain countries, and they destroyed the business of one particular individual who actually immigrated legally from one of those countries. To me, that doesn't make much sense. But it seems to me that there's something going on in our country today. It's called outrage. And you've probably seen a lot of it. Outrage, it's seen from two sides. One, it's an act of extreme violence or viciousness. And there's a lot of that going on. And second of all, it's something that is grossly offensive to decency, morality, or good taste. And then lastly, it's the resentful anger aroused by violent or offensive act. And I think to some degree because there is so much sort of rumors going around about who's doing what and so forth, that we get outraged easily around our country. Here are some synonyms to outrage: indignation, anger, rage, fury, and infuriate. A couple of days ago, I had to deal with Comcast. I heard this voice downstairs. Now, Bob, she didn't cause the problem. She's just telling you about it. I don't know what it is, but sometimes dealing with people can produce that. But it does kind of seem like I think our country is a little bit more in the outrage mode. In fact, there's a headline that I saw online where there are certain people today who are kind of promoting the protests of our current president who are worried about outrage fatigue. Do you know what that means? They're worried that people are going to get apathetic because they do so much protesting. So see, they want to keep it up. Now, of course, part of the sad thing about it is, you know, and I'm sure you probably have some friends, we can get caught up in this so easily because we see something that we think is just so dumb. Now, sometimes outrage is good in us. I mean, remember when Jesus went into the temple and he was outraged at what they were doing with the selling and the merchandising and so forth, and he threw them all out? Man, I want to see that. That's my top five things I want to see when we get to heaven. I want to see Jesus outraged and throwing them out. Something that happened here recently, there was a fellow, he was in a pickup truck, and I think the pickup truck wasn't the normal kind. I think it was jacked up a little bit. Anyways, with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's daughter, and he was stopped at a traffic light, but there was cars in front of him, so he couldn't move, and the guy in the car behind him got out and came over. The driver's window was down, and he started punching him. Well, the girlfriend, in order to try to get the guy to stop doing it, sort of hinted that she had a gun in order to make him back off. And he said, oh, you want to see a gun? I'll show you guns. So he started back to his car. And so the kid, he was 18, 19 years old. He was kind of scared that this guy really had a gun. So what he did, he put it in reverse and backed over the guy's car in order to prevent him from getting into it. I mean, he actually got on top of it and smashed it down. Now, that's kind of an outrage you can sort of kind of get behind, can't you? Still, though, I think, though, that there's a lot of reasons why we go through outrage. And I want to share some of those with you. But I want to talk a little bit about handling outrage tonight. 1 Peter chapter 2, 21 through 25. Peter writes, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his footsteps, who committed no sin, nor was there any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that he might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed, for you were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls." I have to admit, I hate it when I'm attacked. I mean, just to me, there is no such thing as constructive criticism. Any criticism is personal, and I get in defense mode. I'm sure it's got something to do with my when I was a kid and so forth, but I have a hard time handling it. And yet, here is Jesus being accused of things he didn't commit, and all the while he knows it's all part of a plan, and yet he keeps his mouth shut. And I love how John records that Pilate is amazed and says, "Don't you know I have the power to release you and the power to crucify you?" And Jesus, in the midst of that suffering, my guess is he smiled and said, "Oh, no, you don't." Handling outrage. Well, there's a lot of different areas in which we become outraged. One of them, of course, is politics. And right now, politics seems to rule our country. But Romans 13, verses 1 through 7 reminds us who's really in charge. No authority is put in place except God allows it. I don't care, you know, and that's true of Hitler. It's true of Stalin and Lenin. It's true of Mussolini. It's true of Idi Amin. You remember him back in the 60s and 70s over in Uganda. And why that happens, I have no idea. But God is the one in charge. And it's easy for me to get outraged about what's going on, but I just have to remember who's really in charge. Sometimes I get a little outraged that we want to imbue our presidents with a God-given mission. God didn't talk to them. God didn't send them a message. God didn't, on Facebook said, "Hey, President, here's what I want you to do." So we've got to remember, though, that what God does is God gives us a revealed word, and if we live by it, that's a good thing. And if we have a president and if we have elected leaders who try to live by it as well, that's a good thing too. But we still have to remember, ultimately, God's the one in charge. I really love what Daniel says, and I didn't put it down. Daniel chapter 2, when Daniel's interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he lets him know that God is the one who puts kings on the throne and God takes them off. And that happens. And so we have to remember it. In both Romans and in 1 Peter, both Paul and Peter tell us to honor those who are chosen, those who are in office. We may not like, now that doesn't mean we can't be critical. Sometimes I think people talk about, preachers sometimes talk about politics, it's like you got to keep your mouth shut. That's not true. We live in a great country that allows us to criticize. We live in a great country that allows us to protest peacefully. We live in a great country that allows us to speak up. We live in a great country that says, I don't like what you're doing. And I have the freedom to say that. We live in a great country like that. And as Christians who are citizens of this great country, I say, God bless you if you've got the gumption to speak up and to do something about it. What Paul and Peter remind us is, though, is that we do it respectfully and that we remember who's really ultimately in charge. We also find outrage in the church. Can you believe that? We get outraged sometimes in church. Why? Because we don't get our way. Because nobody sees things the way I do. Now, Matthew 18 is more of a specific case where Jesus says, if your brother sins, you go to him. But I really think to some degree that that's a good general approach. That anytime somebody does something that bothers you, go talk to them. And if they come to talk to you first, don't get in the way. If you're a friend that they're not outraged at and they come talk to you, don't get in the way. Because when you start letting them talk to you, then you become the wall between them and the person they're outraged at. Force them to go talk to the person they're mad at. And so if they come, I'm not listening. That's the way we handle outrage at church. Now, we are supposed to be harmonious. We're supposed to be at one like the Father and the Son are. We're supposed to be the ones to demonstrate to the world what the peace of God is really like. And so we need to handle outrage here. And that means talking to one another. And that means not getting in the way if something's going on, but making sure that people resolve things. Family is also a place where outrage occurs. And yet, we have very well-defined roles within the family in Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3. And, of course, we're allowing, there are many churches today, and I'm not talking about our fellowship, I mean just churches in general, that kind of allow our culture to determine how the family goes. How the family structure is changed and how the family relates to each other. And not necessarily saying that we know perfectly what God's Word says, but I think that we've allowed our society to kind of push us away. And a lot of preachers are afraid to stand up and say, well, this is the way, the Bible lays it out, and this is the way we're going to follow it. There are probably not many places, not many churches in America today where when you come to services, you see nothing but men. That's the way we are, but that's the way we believe that God has crafted things within the family and within the family structure and within the church. And so we believe that God created us in a certain way and created us to relate together in a certain way. Men and women are not the same. And you're thinking, well, yeah, of course, that's something we've all known. Even my kids, when they were little, they knew there was a difference between, of course, now, my daughters thought they could still beat up my brother. And I tried to tell them, one of these days he's going to get bigger than you are. But they never listened. But, sometimes family is the place where outrages happens sometimes the most. It seems that family has the ability to provide great love and great hurt. Outsiders. People outside the church, people who are not Christians. Romans chapter 12. Verses 17 and 18. Paul says, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the mind of the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. And then Colossians chapter 4. Verses 5 and 6, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of every opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to respond to each person. When people interact with us on the outside and then find out we're Christians, how we treat them has a great effect on how they now view the church and Christianity. And so we need to remember then how we behave out in the world. There are people watching, and they may one day find out who we are, and if we treat them properly, that's a good thing. Another outrage is enemies. Again, going back to Romans chapter 12. Paul says, bless those who persecute you and do not curse. And then Jesus, of course, famously said in Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 27, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. And whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to anyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. Treat others the same way you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good, and lend expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Imagine that. Love your enemies and pray for them. Do not curse them. Do good to them. You see, that's what makes us different in the world. And the reason why it makes us different is because we follow the lead of the one who actually put that in practice. That's exactly what Jesus did, and that's what 1 Peter reminds us, that when he was reviled, he didn't revile back. When he was beaten, he didn't beat back. When he was cursed, he didn't curse back. Instead, he followed through with the Father being in charge. One last passage I didn't put down, but I thought of later, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I think what's pertinent about Romans 12, 1 and 2 is that it follows the list of faithful in chapter 11 of Hebrews. And it's written to a group of people who are being persecuted, and they are quitting the faith. And he's trying to show them all these people who suffered and held on. But then he ends with a look at Jesus in chapter 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's what he offers to us. To come and follow him and to endure what this world gives to us, despising the shame of it, but realizing the joy of what's up ahead. And you see, that's why we don't have to fix everything today. I mean, that doesn't mean we can't fix things now, but it means we don't have to fix everything. And when sometimes it seems like we're not, people aren't responding, we don't have to get outraged. We don't have to get mad. We don't have to get angry. We don't have to get infuriated, because we serve a God that is beyond that. We serve a God who has a home waiting for us. We serve a God who's ruling over all of this. We serve a God who became one of us and set the example. And so he calls us to live that light out in the world. And so as our country gets in this big outrage mode, they ought to see in us a sense of calm, a sense of peace, so that they might be influenced. And if we truly believe that in some ways we are a Christian nation because we were built on the foundation of Christian principles, then we ought to exhibit those to the rest of our country and show them this is what a Christian looks like. This is what a Christian acts like. And that way, they will be influenced for good, and maybe they will get outrage fatigue real quick. And they will come to be at peace with the fact that our Father rules not only this country, but the whole world and the whole universe. That's our responsibility. That's our goal. But it's our privilege to serve our King in such a way that others will be drawn to Him. So this week, don't be outraged at anything. Just smile, and may the peace of God that passes all understanding be yours, and set your heart at peace as well. Tonight, if you need to respond to the invitation, we want to give you the opportunity. If you're not yet a Christian, want to become one, to confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized into His name by faith, then we give you that opportunity. And as a brother or sister, if there's something you need to tell us or share with us, we want to hear about it, because we want to share in what's going on in your life, pray with you, support you, and encourage you. And if there's anything going on, let us know. If you can't do it publicly, seek a brother or sister out privately. But whatever, make sure that you handle it with you, between you and your Lord. But if you want to share something, please come while we stand and sing.